That's right, folks. That's right. It's our 200th podcast, Reef Threads podcast number 200. I'm still Gary.
And I'm Christine.
And boy, we have guests with us tonight. We have Rich Ross. Hi, Rich.
Hey, Gary and Christine.
We have Jeremy. We have the famed Jeremy.
Yeah, hi.
And we have with us Ben Johnson.
Hey, Gary. Hey, Christine. Hey, Rich. Hey, Jeremy.
Ben has nothing to blow.
Yeah, well,
that didn't come out right either.
Yes.
So we made it 200 of these things. I have to say, I've been kind of semi excited here all week. This is a real milestone. I'm excited. This is great.
I think so too. Yeah. It's amazing actually, 200. And I think what's more amazing is that we've pretty much managed to do it every single week with rare exception.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I just think it's a really neat accomplishment. And, you know, I remember starting this thing out and wondering if there was going to be enough content to get through 3 weeks. And, anymore, there's just so much stuff that we can't cover it and in any given podcast. So, to say we're going to run out is just highly unlikely. It's just great. And then having guests along the way. I mean, Rich, you've been with us how many times? Two or three, huh?
Yeah,
34.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
34.
34 of the 200, yes. Mm-hmm. So that makes you a regular.
I'm really Christine. Yeah. I want to say 200 of anything is a big deal. But 200 of anything in this hobby and industry, that's a huge deal. You know, staying power and stick-to-itiveness, you guys really deserve a huge pat on the back and congratulations for it. It's a real accomplishment, and it really enriches the community. So thank you so much.
Thanks. Yep, that's pretty exciting. As part of our 200th podcast, we have a contest. And that's why Jeremy is here. Jeremy is going to announce our podcast. So tell us about it, Jeremy.
So we've been getting a lot of people saying that, you know, I listen to the podcast when, you know, I'm tending to my tank or when I'm driving a tractor or, you know, when I'm building a house. So we thought it was a good idea to basically make a whole contest of that. And it can be really anything. The one that kind of catches our eye most while I was listening to podcasts. So basically like the explanations I said before.
So the best story.
Yeah, the best story.
And
but not
you
too
enter?
Long.
And where do they have to put the story, Jeremy?
You go to the Reef.
You go to the Reef Threads Facebook page.
The Reef Threads Facebook page. The Reef.
Say that five times fast now. Come on.
The Reef Threads Facebook page.
Yeah.
Well done. Yeah.
Okay, so sum it up here, Jeremy. They're gonna go where and to what?
The Reef Threads.
I'm having you sum it up, so you have to say Reef Threads Facebook page again. Yes.
The Reef Threads Facebook page.
There you go. All right, so I got to write their story there, and Christine and I will look at them, and we'll decide which is the one that most interests us.
Yes.
Well, actually, we'll probably have you involved in the
yeah,
judging.
I was going to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and there's the train. All right, we're good.
Yes. Cool. Well, thank you, Jeremy.
Okay.
Bye.
Thanks, Jeremy. All right, so put those up. We'll probably go a couple weeks waiting for stories. You know, where is it that you listen to the Reef Threads podcast? And we do have a prize. We have a free subscription. Sure, I've got Jeremy disease now. Free subscription to Coral Magazine. So a real prize there. So the one that strikes our fancy the most is the winner, and we'll get a free subscription to Coral Magazine. So that's pretty good, because if you don't read Coral Magazine, you're missing out. So
excellent. That'll be fun.
So on our Facebook page, got to be on the Facebook page, not the website. Got to be on the Facebook page so that people can see it. And it's okay to like us on the Facebook page. We're getting tantalizingly close to 600. So
there we go.
Yeah, we'll take that. So this is great. 200 episodes here, and we have Rich and Ben to just kind of spend the next 45 minutes or so just kind of talking about the hobby and. Yeah, it lasts, 3 years now? 3 years or 4 years?
Three years.
Kind of what's going on here? I mean, this hobby's been through a lot of changes since we started this little adventure. And just an awful lot, I mean, in terms of imports and aquaculturing and people working to save reefs and so on and so forth. And I don't know, is probably one of the more exciting areas, equipment. Have we seen a lot of change in equipment in the last 3 or 4 years?
I don't know. I don't think I've really been that excited. What do you guys think?
What do you think,
Ben? Definitely for me, I'm a installer, so yeah, I see equipment changes all the time. That's, I don't know, that's probably one of my excitements in the industry for sure. But I mean, you're asking in the last 3 to 4 years,
right?
Yeah, actually, before we do that, Ben, tell the listeners what you do. they don't know you. Tell the listeners what you do.
And by the way, Gary and Christine, thanks so much for having me. It almost feels like someone didn't show up, and I'm like the fill-in, like cat psychic on a show because someone didn't show up. My name is Ben. I'm the owner of Captive Aquatic Ecosystems in Houston, Texas. I've been in business since 2002. I've been in this industry since 1995. I don't really deal in the hobbyist end of it. I do this for people who are not hobbyists in the whatsoever, and I install and maintain systems for them.
I kind of like that because you have a sort of a look at the other end of the saltwater aquarium world, because we will often talk about, you know, what's important to us or how the hobby is influencing the world. But we have acknowledged the fact that there's a much larger portion of the consumers of both equipment and livestock that are not hobbyists and that, you know, use the services of people like you. So we don't take their opinions or their desires into account often. So you being part of that world can really speak for that whole side of saltwater aquarium keeping.
Yes, let's just hope I don't mess it up.
Well, so, okay, is it more your opinion and then you convince them of what they should do, or do you mostly go by what people suggest?
Well, I mean, having done this now for a while, I've had to, you know, just like anyone would in any industry, had to refine my approach, because in the beginning, possibly I was coming in too much as the hobbyist trying to tell people what they want. And most of the time they want to be told what they want because I'm the professional. They have no clue. These are people, these are doctors, these are lawyers, these are people that own oil companies. They, you know, saw an aquarium somewhere and they Googled me and found me. That's as much as they know about aquariums. But from time to time you get someone that has delved a tiny bit into the industry. And so they kind of throw around some things they may be looking at. And probably one of the most frustrating things is when I get people that are not aquarists and they contact me and they want something like a shark and stuff like this. It just drives me up the wall. Which of course that can be done properly, but it's never as exciting as people make it out to be.
Yeah, well, according to the tank guys, sharks like to swim in circles, I hear. So, there you go.
And people always talk about how, you know, that show, you know, even people not in the industry will talk about, oh, doesn't that show, you know, help you? Or, you know, and I, always end up sighing in the beginning because it's this long diatribe, and I, you know, it always makes me kind of sound negative because I just have nothing negative but negative to say about it. So I try to be careful with that.
Yeah. Well, the reason I start out with equipment is I think particularly in the last, I don't know, well, certainly in the last 5 years that we've seen a lot of advance in flow and flow control and a tremendous advance in controllers and what they can do. I think that's two areas where there's been a lot of advance for the regular hobbyist. I don't know from your perspective, Ben, if that matters much in what you do, but
you know,
I think there's been a lot of gain there.
When I first started doing this, it was common to take a maxi jet, actually to take like a dozen maxi jets and bury them all in the rock structure. And when a maxi jet died, you would just, and this is so horrible, especially looking back on it now, but you would cut the cord and leave it in place if you couldn't get to it. We didn't know that, you know, you're just leaving it open to copper wiring and everything else. And that was an interesting thing, like you said, the last 5 years, the ditching of the impeller driven pumps for water flow to propeller driven pumps.
Maybe now too, I don't even, what the gyre pump is, what are they calling that?
Yeah, the max spec gyre. I don't know. It's almost, it's like a water wheel, but I don't really know because it's the geometry of it is interesting because it's like you took a prop pump and just stretched it out and
had the flow go in
a perpendicular direction.
Go ahead, Ben.
I haven't gotten my hands on one yet, but from what I've seen, there's a type of fan called a squirrel cage that firemen and also, Surf Pro and people will use to air out carpets. And to me, that's what it looks like, that, like an elongated impeller shaft with long blades on it. But I need to get a hold of one first.
Yeah. I'm just wondering what they're going to call it because it's not a propeller. It's not an impeller. So it looks really great.
We should name it. We should just come up with a name.
We should call it a billy pump.
A billy pump?
A billy pump.
It's a bill peller.
A Billy Peller?
It's a Billy Peller.
Yeah, is the inventor named Bill?
No, I just, things are generally named Billy or Susan, so.
There you go.
Maybe in your world, Rich.
Well, I don't live in anybody else's.
I'm getting, one of those is supposed to be coming my way, and I'm really pretty excited to see what it does. From what I've seen of it, they look great, so I really want to see it in action. And then I'm hoping I really like it, which I think I'm going to. And then I want, you know, one that's 4 feet long.
Yeah,
I
think that I wonder if it's scalable. I can't think of any reason why it wouldn't be.
I can't think of it either.
As long as the motor has enough torque to be able to pull, you know, those 4 foot long billy pellers, it should work.
Right now, the manufacturer is just going, oh, no.
Are you kidding? The manufacturer is thrilled because we've just created a buzzword.
It's going to be in their next ad.
Yes, it
the
will.
Billy Peller.
Mm-hmm.
Go, Billy
Peller. To me, that development really speaks to the fact that there's just an awful lot of effort going into flow and finding the right kind of flow. And, we've talked. Many people talk about developing some kind of a gyre motion in the tank in general, and from what we've seen and heard about this thing, it really does that, and does it quite effectively. So yeah, it'll be interesting. I'll be curious, Rich, on your larger tank to see what that does. And I mean, you have a lot of rock and a lot of coral in there, so it'll be interesting to see if it moves the water better. If it starts to flush things out a little better and improves things, or just what happens there?
Yeah, I'm really interested to try it at home. I've got a place to try it at home in one corner, which I think would be great. Actually, two corners. And then at work, you know, and just I like the small profile of it because we have a lot of frames around our tanks, so it would be really easy to put one in place and not have the public see it at the Steinhardt Aquarium. In the California Academy of Sciences in Golden Gate Park.
Oh, there he goes.
have to do it at least once. But in our coral holding troughs, I run them as gyres, so all the corals are lifted off the bottom of the tank about 4 to 6 inches, and then there's a Rio Hyperflow 32 in each corner, and they come on from one side of the tank and blow the water one direction, and then the other side, and then both at the same time, and I'm really interested to see how the gyre does, the gyre pump moves water in that application. I'm not as excited or about creating a gyre. I think we could do that with any pump. But man, those things look like they move a lot of water for a little bit of watts, and yeah, that's pretty hip.
At the last Macna, Paul Whitby of High Def Corals, he had one of them on his frag tank, which was, I don't know, maybe 3 foot by 6 foot.
Yeah, it's 2x6. 2x6 by about a foot tall.
And it was really moving it. He had it turned down to like 30%.
Yeah. So that's cool. Yeah, people are really looking at stuff like you were saying, Gary. I think you're right. And just technology in general has taken a step forward really on the consumer level in the past 4 or 5 years. And that's really starting to make its way into the hobby. I mean, almost every light now you can get controllable. It's not just, the controllers themselves. It's this technology is now started being built into everything. And I think we're going to see more of that. We're going to see more, wireless stuff happening, because why wouldn't you put a wireless, chip in any machine you have to let the person control it from their phone? It's almost too easy now.
Yeah, that's the part that I think is interesting, because people will do more with it if they can do it from a device that they already have in their hands.
And it's so much safer. Man, it's so much, you can buy a really good power strip now and you're not trying to unplug things with wet hands. I mean, not a power strip. You buy a controller that controls the outlets, and you're just flipping buttons on your smartphone rather than trying to unplug something. And I think that's just a great way to go. It makes it so much easier and so much saner.
Yeah, anything that gets rid of that rat's nest of cords in the back of those tanks is worth it.
Yeah. Yeah.
As an installer, I'm not a big fan of cords, and I'm just waiting for the day for that to happen, because I always have to find a way to route all that stuff cleanly. Because, like I said, this isn't for hobbyists. This is for wealthy individuals, and I can't open, not even the bottom, can't open it up and say, there's your tank, and it's just a nasty mess.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, you have to be right the first time, Ben. That's what kills me about organizing the stuff. You know, at home, I have the rat's nest because I'm tinkering, so I'm moving stuff around all the time. So I don't really want to zip tie everything down, because then if I want to make a change, I've got to unzip tie everything. But I'm sure in your line of work, you gotta make the decisions at the beginning and nail it down. I think that's pretty neat.
And actually, I can't stand zip ties. I use small Velcro loops, because then I can, like you said, I can make those changes without having to clip a zip tie.
Yeah, you still gotta undo 50 of them, but absolutely point taken. The Velcro is much better.
Some pumps too will come for, no good reason, will come with like 20 feet of cord. So sometimes I'm not suggesting everyone run out and do this, but sometimes I will I'll clip the cord and put a new cord on there, from like a home improvement store, just because I don't need 20 feet of rolled up, line dragging into the power strip.
That's a good idea. I like that.
I mean, consult your local electrician before you do that.
Yes.
Rich, you brought up as part of one of your comments there about the Steinhardt Aquarium at the California Academy of Sciences and wherever that is. And yeah, that place. And by the way, I'll just speak from personal experience. You get to San Francisco, you get your butt to the Steinhardt, because you got to see it.
Thanks.
I've said that a million times. I'll say it a million times more. But I would suggest that there has been a tremendous advancement, and I'm sure that we can attribute a lot of it to what you guys are doing, what Joe Waiulo is doing. I think there's been a tremendous advancement in just the past 4 or 5 years in public aquariums, particularly reef aquariums and showing marine animals. There's just been an awful lot of effort, I would suggest across the board, even down to smaller public aquariums, to really improve marine animal habitats and the way they're shown, and to really help the public gain a better appreciation and understanding of these animals. I just remember, you know, many, many years ago, you'd see a marine tank and it was usually just algae and just some kind of half dead corals, and then a few fish, and you come back 2 weeks later and it'd be a few different fish. And I don't think that's the case anymore. I know you guys are, but in general, public aquariums are putting together habitats and displays that have some real longevity to them, and animals are thriving, and we're seeing corals and fish with more normal behavior rather than just swimming in circles. And I think that's a real plus.
Thanks. It's very, very kind of you to say things like that about where I work. And I think that this, you know, I would credit that, at least in the U.S., with Joe Waiulo for sure. He kind of went and showed us, look what you can do on a large scale. And
yeah, he set the bar, really.
Yeah, this is what reef tanks are supposed to look like. And if it doesn't look like that, what are you doing? And I think that's really made people kind of go, oh, we better do this right. And, you know, if Joe can do it on that scale, you know, we should definitely be able to do it on a smaller scale. And I think, you know, the technology has also made it a lot easier to pull off. You know, we now know, and when I say we, I mean all of us, know more about what these animals need. And it's and you can get a lot of off-the-shelf solutions to make it happen. And a lot of different methodologies work, but you can do it. And I think you're right. I think that transition is important and beautiful, and it really does help the public be informed about what's going on under the water.
Well, when you and Matt and company inherited that beast that you guys have, that was some rock and a few fish. I mean,
yeah.
And you guys really had to go to town and really fight for what you knew was right to build that up. And it takes a long time, but it's that kind of commitment too that brings these things to life and really makes the experience for the attendees that much better, I think.
Yeah, thank you very much. And, you know, those big tanks like our tank in Georgia and Max Jantz's tank, and, you know, these are huge, huge tanks that people really haven't done that big before. And, man, everything's an adventure. And it's like Charles Delbecq always calls it, it's like steering an oil tanker, you know. you make a little change, and then in 6 months, it's, you know, a little change in your steering, and then in 6 months, you're, instead of in Hawaii, you know, you're in Antarctica. So that's really kind of a thing with these tanks is, you know, once they start to go one direction, you don't know really what it is that you need to change because it's so massive. And so they're really interesting to watch the development of these larger reef tanks, you know, over 100,000 gallons, you know, and to watch them, you know, bloom for a while and then, you know, have their trials and tribulations just like everybody else's tanks do. So that's a really kind of cool learning experience to look at a captive ecosystem on that scale.
You know what? Another interesting perspective, and perhaps it's a bit negative, but I spent 2 years at the Houston Zoo, and, you know, and not to take the conversation down, people like Rich and Joe in these other places, I mean, set the bar very high. But there's so many other, it's frustrating when people, you know, like us that do this, go to, you know, other zoos, aquariums for the most part. And it's incredible because now hobbyists can do so much that they make these other institutions who you would think, you know, could pull this stuff off. When I worked at the Houston Zoo, I was sourced solely because I was a hobbyist, which I thought was really strange because everyone else that worked there had marine biology degrees. But they weren't thinking out of the box. And, you know, with these smaller zoos and aquariums, mostly zoos, I guess I would say, there's a whole process to acquiring things, livestock, equipment, that would just make your head spin. And it's frustrating. I think it's frustrating when people drag me to other, you know, smaller aquariums and zoos because I'm just being negative when I'm there, seeing, you know, head and lateral line erosion and a skimmer from 20 years ago and, you know, stuff like this.
Yeah, I think that there's a greater – what's happened is what used to be sort of an even middle ground has now gone more to the extremes, and maybe it's just because we do have the bar set high with the two aquariums on the coast. I know for me, you know, you go to plenty of other aquariums and the general opinion is meh, you know. There's – it's it just becomes unimpressive. And the other thing too, and maybe this is just for us because we see it so much. When you see somebody's tank in someone's house and it blows the public aquarium's tank out of the water, then I think they should be doing a better job.
Exactly. You just said more succinctly what I was trying to say.
Yeah, it's a weird thing, you know, because at public aquariums, you know, there's a lot you have to do.
Yeah.
You know, at home, you know, Matt Wandel says this all the time. This is his comparison. You know, when you're at home and you want to change out a pump, you go get a pump. When you're at a public aquarium and you want to change out a pump, you can't just go get a pump. You have to go through the channels to justify why you want to spend that money, on a different pump. And when you're talking, you know, bigger tanks, it's even worse because it's just more and more money. And then there's paperwork to do. And if you're an AZA institution, there's regulations that you have to comply with, and all of these are good things. Otherwise you end up with, you know, rogue aquariums that do weird things, and we don't want that. That just gives everybody a black eye. So there's a lot of stuff you got to do. And it takes time and it takes money, and you're only there for 8 hours a day when you're at home with your own aquarium, you're there 24/7, you know, messing with stuff. So it's a, you know, now having been on both sides of that equation, I have a new understanding and feeling for public aquariums that are trying to do better but don't have the staffing or the time or the funds. Does that excuse it? No. I mean, we're talking about animals and they should be kept well. I just have a better feel and compassion for that situation.
Right. You know the reasons why it looks like that.
Yeah. I mean, if you got a vet who doesn't know anything about you know, a lot of these places have veterinarians, and just to interrupt myself to speak to what Ben was saying, a lot of places are looking at people who have practical aquariums experience now more than just, you know, some kind of science degree, which is great, but there's no applied science. You know, it's very different to study an organism and then to keep it alive. It's two very different things, right? So, if you've got a veterinarian who doesn't know much about fish and you're trying to explain to them, you know, about a new treatment for cryptocarium that you've heard about, and they want to, you know, stick with copper in a reef tank, that can get a little bit trying. And you know, how far do you go to bat at work for anything? And so put yourself in that aquarist's place who's trying to make something happen when the organization around them isn't at that same place in their thought. It can be daunting. So I really do have compassion. I mean, you know, I see it at work too, that, you know, I have to work within the framework of an organization, and it's, you know, things don't necessarily move as quickly as I'd like to, but that's what it is. And we try our best.
Yeah. I was at the Houston Zoo from 2002 to 2004. And I was really excited when I started working. I was put in charge of the 4,000 gallon reef tank, and I thought I could just carte blanche, just, you know, change all this stuff, but it wasn't like that whatsoever. So I had to concentrate on improving the aquarium itself. And then, you know, I was real frustrated because it was 3 500 gallon tanks linked together with a common 1,000 gallon sump. So the lighting for each of the tanks was 2 1,000 watt halides in the front and 2 400 watt halides in the back. Well, the 2,000 watts in the front of each tank were like, what were they, like 5,000 Kelvin denture bulbs, you know, yes. And they were on tar ballast, and I was wanting to, you know, upgrade that to, you know, 10,000 Kelvin with electronic ballast. But, you know, the senior aquarist just kind of looked at me and laughed. And I was like, what, you know, what's going on? And he's like, you got to go to admin. You got to get someone to donate money for that, you know, blah, 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 yada, yada. So it was fun, but it was also frustrating.
Yeah. And let's face it, the guy who was there before you also wanted to change everything and maybe got those ballasts and those bulbs, which were a step up from what was what before. So every time a new person comes in, they want to gut the system and start again. And, you know, that costs time and money. So
I actually learned something very valuable from that mindset that carried on to what I do professionally now, because every time I wanted to make all sorts of plumbing changes or skimmer change or this, you know, the admin there would always temper me in that, you know, these were very expensive fiberglass tanks with acrylic fronts. And you can't just decide to cut a hole in here and, oh, you can put a bulkhead on there and plug it up later. You can't do that. So what that caused me to do is think very carefully about every time you change something about a system. Is this just kind of flippant and you might change back later, but then you've altered your system in some way where you're going to have to scrap the sump and buy a new one, you know, so you have to make very careful decisions before you go drilling and cutting things. Think about it long and hard before you make those changes.
Yeah, good points.
I don't know if this is a fair transition or not, but we have hobbyist tanks in which we have a very high expectation, and we see time and time again beautiful hobbyist tanks of all kinds, soft coral, hard coral, fish only, all those things. And then we're seeing these the public aquariums reach a much, much higher level than they ever have in many cases. Are we seeing that expectation and that bar translate over to local fish stores? Are we seeing them advance, or are they getting left out of the equation here?
I think it depends where you're at.
Geographically, or do you mean
geographically? If you are lucky enough to have professionals in or local fish stores in your area that know what they're doing, everyone is that lucky.
Yeah, I don't even know if that has anything to do with the geography. I think it's more, to me, it seems to be more about whether they happen to hire the right kid who is, you know, who's getting into the hobby and loves it, you know. So I think it's really hit or miss. Because that seems to be usually the best help you will get is from a teenager that is completely geeked about working there and about, you know, keeping fish.
Yeah, and then they leave in 2 years.
Exactly.
And the system goes to hell because it's somebody else's system. You now have to wear somebody else's pants.
Right, right.
That's a weird thing. Gary, I'll say that I think that this brings up, you know, what has changed in the last 4 or 5 years. I think local fish stores have changed a whole lot. You know, here in the Bay Area, we used to have a plethora of piñatas, a plethora of fish stores. You could throw a stick and you would hit a store. And now, you know, where I'm at, there's two, and they're 35, 40, 50 minutes away. You know, there's not as many as there used to be. So, and these ones are stepping up their game. They almost always have a really nice display tank. But even better is, you know, their stuff that they have for sale is set up much nicer than, you know, a tank with some grimy stuff in it and some corals on a stick. So I think that's changed. I think the stores that are staying around, at least in my area, are really, you know, they have to be good. They have to be good, and they have to be fair priced, and you know, not cheap. The cheap ones go away just as fast as the ones that are too expensive, interestingly. So
at the last MACNA, Jim Walters gave a great talk about he's the owner of Old Town Aquarium in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
About the trials and tribulations of Amazon and, you know, the niche that you're trying to fill in a store nowadays. He had a really interesting outlook on it, where I think a lot of stores think that they're chasing the upper echelon of hobbyists, when mm-hmm. I don't really see how that can be that profitable. And what Jim has done is he's concentrating more on the beginning, on guiding people from the beginning correctly.
Well, that makes more sense because there's more beginners anyway.
Right. Yes.
It's good to hear somebody saying it out loud.
surprised that. Do you think people don't? Yeah. Do people deny that there's more beginners than there are?
Oh yeah. Oh, I think so. I think people.
Really?
Yeah, because you can't track the beginners. You can't talk to them. They're just off in the ether buying their stuff, and they stay around for a year, year and a half, and then they go away, and you never, you know, how many of those do we actually see?
I don't think we see hardly any, because I think that probably for every one of us, there's 10 other people that get a tank, especially now that nanos have become so affordable, where you can buy an all-in-one system for under $200. That set up a tank like it's a freshwater tank and have success for a month and then fail miserably because they haven't understood the system that they're keeping, and then they're done. You know, just go on Craigslist if you need a small tank, and you will find one. So yeah. I'm surprised that anybody would even try to pretend that that doesn't happen.
Well, maybe it's not that they pretend, it's that they don't even really realize it, because trying to get cachet, you know, in the hobby, when you're a store, you're trying to get people online to talk about you. But those, you know, are those really your customers, or are, I guess it depends on your store, right? I mean, you know, if you don't have a store, if you have a store that just has corals and doesn't sell systems, who's your real customer? Somebody who's already in it. So maybe everything I said is wrong.
No, I don't think so at all, because, you know, when you think about it, the end user that's been in the hobby for a while, how much equipment and corals are they really going to be buying? You know, they'll buy the gyre pump when it comes out, but they've got a skimmer, they've got lights, you know, maybe once a year they'll do an upgrade on something, but that's not nearly the income you can get by doing a brand new system for somebody. So I think that you can't ignore the new customers.
What I think is that people get so excited about the customer that's going to buy a wrought iron butterfly or a black tang, because you're going to get to bring that into your store. But if most people know what the profit margins are on things like that to the store walk-in person, it's dismal. So from a money-making sense, it makes no sense to chase that. You're chasing that for the, you know, the glory of the rarity of it. But if you're chasing that as a store, you're almost doomed for failure. What you need to concentrate more on is setting the people in the beginning on the right track. They'll be with you the entire time, hopefully.
Yeah.
Well, and I really enjoyed Jim's talk, because, I mean, I've known and been to Old Town Aquarium many times and would consider it to be a very high-end store with very high-quality product across the board. And, it's always been that way. What it's been there 30 plus years is probably, it's gotta be one of the oldest stores in the entire country, and has always, always maintained a very high level, in terms of its animals, its tanks and the way they look. And they have freshwater as well as marine. And, for him to, you know, I think it really speaks to his business savvy to say that his real customer is the entry level person and getting them into the hobby, and then watching them grow in the hobby. And it's not people like us who've been here forever and really don't buy that much stuff on an ongoing basis. And, you know, I mean, his store has always been just absolutely top notch, from the display tank in the front window that everybody stops and looks at, to everything all the way to the back of the store. And I think it really speaks well to his understanding, and particularly in this age where he was talking about people being able to buy equipment for less than he can buy at wholesale, buy equipment online for less than he has to pay wholesale. That's a tough business to be in. But he's been, and I really hope we can get him on a podcast here in the near future, because it really speaks to the savvy that you have to be a successful store owner. And I think it also speaks to why so many stores fail, because so many of them are hobbyists who decide they're going to have a store, don't understand business and the market and all those things. And, you know, 2 years later, they have to bow out because they can't sell anything, can't make a profit because they don't understand what they're doing. And, for him to, he's not been the sole owner of that store, but for him to do it as long as he's done it, really speaks well to a full understanding of what it's like to be in the business, particularly in this market.
You know, what strikes me too, as I'm listening to you guys, as we sort of celebrate the reef only stores, you know, the saltwater stores, because we, you know, oh, these are our friends and they're hobbyists usually and that sort of thing. But I think that it's actually a much smarter idea when we're talking about cultivating the beginners to have a store that's blended, because how do most people come into the saltwater hobby is they start with freshwater tanks. So that's a great sort of customer base that you have that you can pick from, because you'll get the people that are freshwater keepers that, you know, really start getting into it, and they're in the store pretty regularly, you know, buying black worms or whatever. And that's how, that's just customers ripe for the picking, and you can, you know, evangelize to them and bring them over to our side.
Yeah, personally,
I think that's right. I think though the issue with that then is you need double the expertise. So you need the freshwater people who know the freshwater stuff through time, as well as the saltwater people through time. And we know how on a lot of stores, you know, finding that kind of help is a hard part.
Right.
You know, plus you also need double the floor space. And, I don't know what the right answer is, because I've seen, you know, since I've started doing this 30 years ago, we used to have huge pet stores that were just everything stores, you know, and then they kind of shrunk down to just fresh and saltwater, and they let the dogs and cats and mammals go somewhere else. And then we saw even more, you know, paring down of what you carried. So it seems like we're in a phase now where stores, because we have so many fewer boutique stores, it seems like the stores that are bigger, that cater to pets more, whether that just be fresh or saltwater or all kinds of pets, seem to be making a comeback. And maybe that's the way to compete with, you know, the big box stores that are a little bit spooky with their animal choices and their help. Maybe.
Spooky. Okay.
How was that for politic? Spooky.
Yes. Nice tap dance there. Where are we at with clubs? I don't participate in clubs at all. But we all speak at club meetings from time to time. Are clubs growing? Are they shrinking? There's some pretty powerful clubs around the country, but then there's an awful lot of them that I just wonder where that whole thing is going. Is that still a legitimate and viable way of engaging the hobbyist, or has a lot of what the clubs did and have done and are doing been pretty much supplanted by online exchanges?
My opinion is that I'm worried about all volunteer clubs or organizations, because asking volunteers to do so much work over such a length of time, I think, puts you at the whim of people who have time and enthusiasm. And so I think you get a big sawtooth graph of success in these organizations rather than a steady curve or a steady climb. I think you can find exceptions to that, but I think in general you see clubs that burst on and they've got great enthusiasm and they do great things, and then after a couple years, the people who are making all that happen, they're tired and they're burned out because, you know, everyone hates them for trying because everyone else has an opinion but they won't actually do the work. And then you get all this rotation, and then all of the knowledge that is built up when the club is booming goes away because those people all go away. And I have a feeling that's got to do with simply, you know, not paying someone to do kind of the everyday work of running an organization like that. Instead, you've got people, the president of clubs, doing websites and things like that. And I think that runs out of steam at some point, and then the organization has a problem continuing through time.
I think that we've actually had this very conversation speaking more globally about MASNA, because that's one of the hurdles that they have to go through too, is that they have term limits on people. And like you said, it's a volunteer organization that's trying to be the overseer club of clubs. So that's just maybe a more magnified case of exactly the same thing.
I think so.
I've often wondered about the increasing price of running a Magna. Like, when is that going to hit a wall toward what clubs can handle?
As far as the amount of capital they have to raise to be able to put it on?
Well, yeah, like this Magna cost them, you know, $300,000. Well, this next place, they're going to do $400,000, five, six, seven, eight, you know, million-dollar Magna, and then, you know, it's going to destroy a club.
Well, it already destroys club, from what I understand. You know, the clubs fall out, and they're not as active anymore because it's an all – can you imagine being the volunteer head of a $500,000 event?
Ridiculous.
I mean, that's just insane. That's three full-time jobs already as a volunteer. I don't see how that's sustainable over time.
Right, right. Well, maybe that's why they rotate it. You know, we've talked, I think people, you know, will go to a really good Magna and say, you know, they should have Magna in the same place every year. And maybe that's part of the reason that they do it. You know, they rotate so that you don't get burnout.
Well, you just hire a person whose job it is to facilitate getting it done.
Right, or that.
You know, and then it can move from, you know, a team or a person whose actual job for actual money does that. And, you know,
I think I know what's going on here. Rich is trying to create a position for himself.
That's it.
No.
He's the event planner. Richard Ross, event planner.
Rich, yeah. Rich used to do that kind of stuff. Now he has a job. I think it's also analogous to clubs, you know, hiring, you know, why clubs want to administer their own form site. I don't understand why they just don't farm that out, or, you know, people making, you know, flyers, and, you know, it's just so easy to pay people to do that part of the work for you. So you can do the more interesting part that needs your expertise. I think maybe some of the smaller clubs can't afford that, but, you know, even the smaller clubs I know end up with a bunch of money in the bank, and it's just sitting there in the bank, and I'm not quite sure I understand what it's sitting in the bank for. This comes as you know, I co-founded and ran a club for several years and then watched it go through ups and downs afterwards, so and other organizations as well. I think you just relying on a volunteer base for decades is a hard thing to do.
Complete left turn. Aquaculture, captive bred fish. Is that the future? Is that the salvation for this hobby? Is that what's going to keep this hobby alive into the future?
I think captive bred is great. I think mariculture is better. I think getting people in the local nations near the wild reefs, caring and farming the animals there for our consumption is better than just a landlocked kind of production of those animals. Because I think if we don't pay attention to what's happening to the wild reefs and get people caring about those and tending to those, we got more problems than having pretty things in our living rooms.
I agree. I think that's a much better idea, and it goes back to replacing those families' income. You know, so instead of being harvesters, fishers, they can be mariculturists. So we're not changing their lifestyles in any way, and yet we can still maintain the hobby.
I think I would agree with Ben, and I would say perhaps wild collection of at least corals is not the way to do it. Although I think we're going to need some of that forever. But I think what Vincent is doing in Bali, where you collect fragments and then you grow up mother colonies, and then from those colonies you make colonies for sale. So mm-hmm. You're selling frags rather than frags, right?
Right.
You know, you've grown them specifically to sell. I think that's a great way to go, and I think every village, you know, who's done fish and coral collecting forever can translate to that method pretty easily. And there's some kind of in situ pen rearing that's being explored in Bali as well, actually the old Les Village site. And so I think there's some good stuff on the horizon, but I think we need to be careful not to disconnect ourselves from what's going on in the wild and how that will impact us in the long run.
Rich, you get to dive at least once a year in those remote locations. Do you find that the people that live there are receptive to that kind of more formalized business structure rather than the way they've always done it, which is just go out in a little boat and dive and collect a bunch of stuff? Are they receptive to that? Do they understand it? Does it make sense to them?
I think it does, and I think it can. It needs yes is the answer. I think it needs something like a certification scheme, you know, like dare I say the word Mac, you know, bring something like that into play that looks at everything at a wider level rather than individual companies and can help get everyone in an area on the same page. Because what really kills that, what we've been talking about, is when you've got one group here trying to do it the right way, and then two villages down, they're doing it the old way that takes less resources, at least to get going, and they just undercut the prices of what the new way is doing, and they can't compete. So I think we need to figure out a way to get everyone on that page. And I think they're into it. I mean, you know, in the end, once you set it up, it's easier work for everybody. I mean, if you got all the corals that you want growing just off your village and you don't have to spend money and fuel and spend time going out far ranging to collect the same stuff, maybe once or twice a year with permits, you are allowed to go out and get new brood stock to bring back and grow for 3 years before you start cutting it up for sale. I think that's just easier for everyone all the way around and more sustainable, and we'll get better product.
There's a key statement there, as I ultimately think we do end up with better product all the way around, and then that just makes it better back here. Where does the control have to start, though? Does it start in the local villages, or does it start because there's some roadblock here in terms of what can be imported?
I think it depends on who's starting the control. I think if our industry doesn't do it itself, it's going to start with legislation. I'd much rather see us, you know, our industry grab itself by the horns and steer itself into a more sustainable direction and kind of cut off the possible legislation before it even needs to happen.
I mean, to boil it down, it's either going to, you know, we can initiate it somehow, or it's going to be decided for us.
Yeah, and we may not like those decisions.
Exactly. It's like going to divorce court. You can either get through mediation and figure it out with your spouse, or a judge will figure it out for you.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting too to watch people who have corals and fish get very upset about, you know, ESA possible listings of those animals, but they're very happy to champion those kinds of things for, you know, orangutans. So it's a really interesting process to watch.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the right answers are, for sure. It's a crazy, convoluted thing. So, like Red Talbot says, we just gotta keep asking questions.
Yeah, I think that's true.
We need to wrap up here, but before we do that, we have to acknowledge listener Don Davis, who sent us, he's been a listener for a long time. He sent us the horns, sent us Christine and me packages. Horns, and then you could tell he's a listener because he sent all kinds of the things that we've used for tips along the way.
Yes, it was amazing.
The paring knives that Christine mentioned, where you go to the grocery store and you get the paring knives, four different color handles, rescue tape, Christine's
favorite
thing. Ben, the Velcro straps that you talked about, magic erasers, zip ties, a water bottle for spraying to clean the tank glass, duct tape. He sent us these packages, and so thanks to Don for helping make the 200th celebration here kind of complete. That was a really fun package to get. We really appreciate that.
Yeah, that was great.
Are we excited about the future of this hobby, or are we concerned?
Excited and concerned.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I think
it seems like the technology and everything is just on this, you know, meteoric rise, but at the same time, environmental concerns seem to kind of temper that. But let's see if we can, you know, blow out of the ceiling with that, with our hobby, our industry still somewhat intact. Would be interesting.
I think we are primed to be the poster group for dealing with these kinds of things. I think we have the knowledge, we have the technology, we have the passionate people. I think we just all got to get on the same page and start moving in one direction. So we're not working across purposes. You know, there's just no reason we can't be farming all the corals we want. Look what Ken Niedermeyer's doing. I mean, it's, we can do it. It could be so great.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because when you think about, you know, sort of the charismatic megafauna that people like to hang their hats on as, you know, environmental causes, they don't have the ability to actually do something about it. But we do, and, you know, we can grow these animals and reproduce them so easily now. And the other thing is that, you know, you'll always have passionate environmentalists, but I think that passionate hobbyists are a completely different animal, because they have a love of the environment, but they also have a love of the care of these. You know, they're not just looking at them from afar. They have them. They've cared for them. They've raised them from, you know, from frags or from larvae. So they really know what it's like to really live with these animals and understand what they are like up close. So, you know, it's a tremendous resource of passion and energy. And I think it's just going to be a matter of how do we tap that? You know, how do we turn the excitement about the next great skimmer into something that can motivate and change how we treat the environment?
So spaketh the evangelist.
I think we're done.
Gary, I think we're primed for it. I think we're reaching the critical mass for something to happen. I think we're right there. I think I choose to be positive, because that's the world I want to live in.
Well, I'm with you. I'm positive about this hobby too. I think that we do have the ability to really handle this ourselves, and I think you're dead right. Be the poster child. We can be that. So I just hope we do it. We need to be done, unfortunately.
Yeah, I hope we can. Another 200 episodes.
There we go.
You're all right with us.
It was just now getting fun.
Well, Rich and Ben, we sure appreciate you taking the time and getting a chance to chat with you and make this 200th episode a real special one. Thank you for that.
Thanks, guys.
I was honored. I've been listening since the beginning.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much, you guys. Really appreciate it.
Yep, we're glad to do it. And Christine, a virtual high five to you. Yay. We'll be back next. That's it. We'll be back next week with number 201. Thanks for listening.
Take care.